time.
C. C is for...
cauliflower.
Confusion.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio, Feminist Waves brought to you by CKUT and the Center for Gender Advocacy.
The Dragon Root Media Collective aims to bring you feminist content that challenges interlocking systems of oppression and makes space for voices systemically silenced. Dragon Root understands media as being inherently political and emphasizes media skill sharing as a form of resistance.
We meet every other Wednesday at 6 p.m. at the Center for Gender Advocacy and welcome anyone interested in learning or producing feminist media to join. No skills required.
Welcome to Dragon Root Radio. On today's show, we're speaking with the editor of Kohol magazine about their recent issue on queer feminisms. We also will feature a clip with the hosts of Yoga is Dead, which focuses on racism and other issues in the wellness industry. But first up, we are speaking with Cupert McGill on their upcoming Culture Shock event series.
Can you introduce yourself and tell us a bit about Cupert?
Hi, my name is Sasha Simmons. I'm the Working Groups and Community Research Coordinator at Cupert McGill. I'll describe QPIRG first. QPIRG McGill is a nonprofit organization on McGill campus that basically runs as a resource center, trying to connect students together with the larger community in Montreal around issues related to like activism and social justice. So we do that in a pretty large variety of different ways through hosting events, offering work study and summer jobs that students can take part in to learn skills related to community organizing and nonprofit management. My job specifically is as the working groups coordinator is related to running a small grants program that provides logistical support and a bit of budget to autonomous activist groups in the city. Who are working on a lot of different environmental and social justice issues. So there's a lot of different ways that our work looks, but the common denominator amongst all of them is like trying to connect students together with the community and for mutually beneficial purposes, essentially.
Mm-hmm. And so one of the workshops that's coming up is called Creating Anti-Oppressive Workshops. Can you tell us a bit about what this event and what people can expect?
Right. So the Creating Anti-Oppressive Workshops workshop that's coming up, what this workshop is going to be is kind of a primer for anybody who has a topic or a skill that they'd like to share with the community and just needs a little bit of help learning how to format that into a workshop format. So we often see things framed as workshops, little presentations or classes, but I feel like that term can be a little bit vague for somebody who's never attended one before. So the intention of this workshop is just to help people understand like what are some of the norms in scheduling and structuring your information into that kind of format, basically, that's easy to share with the public and engaging and accessible to the most people possible.
Mm-hmm. So one of the emphasis of this workshop is on kind of making workshops anti-oppressive, from what I understand. So can you tell us a bit about what makes a workshop anti-oppressive?
What makes a workshop anti-oppressive will vary pretty widely based on the topic, but there are a lot of things that you can build in just logistically that will help right off the bat. For example, if it's a physical location, like where it is, how easy is it for people to get to, and all of that kind of thing. But as well, I think that the workshop facilitator, Fio, is planning on going over some things that will make workshops anti-oppressive in terms of the people who are actually attending and how the information is structured. So often that can look like giving a variety of different ways for people to participate, setting group intentions so that everybody is on the page, the same page to begin with, for example. Another thing would be offering people the opportunity not to participate. That's pretty important. So I think depending on what kind of workshop it is, that will look really different. Yeah.
I guess to get even more specific, in the event description, it says that one of the aims is to highlight the importance of facilitation as an anti-oppressive and reflective practice. So can you tell us a bit about the role facilitation plays in anti-oppressive workshops tell us more about facilitation.
So my personal experience with anti-oppressive facilitation is a bit less towards workshops and a bit more in the context of a place like QPIRG, where we're a group who's collectively organizing a project together. But I do actually really, really value facilitation as a skill that helps the group process to happen so much more smoothly. So some ways that facilitation can be anti-oppressive, I think, are the facilitator's role is really to keep tabs on who is comfortable to share in the space. So both by the way that they set the space up, the tone that they bring to the meeting, the way that the information is structured to be as clear as possible and to offer pauses in which people can have the chance to reflect, for example. But then also as a facilitator, you're noticing if one person is taking up a lot more of the space, of the talking time, or one type of person, it's your job as the facilitator to draw out, to make sure that as many people as possible are participating. And depending on the subject matter, there are a lot of small things you can do related to, for example, summarizing the conversation that has happened to make sure that everybody's on the same page, that kind of thing. So it's something that is a skill that a lot of people might not think about and that can go unnoticed sometimes, but when it's badly done, you will notice because you will have an uncomfortable experience as a person who's in that workshop or in that meeting.
So true. So I want to shift gears. So that's a bit about the upcoming workshop, but one of the upcoming events is also Culture Shock, which is the annual event from what I understand. So can you tell us a bit about what's planned for this year?
Yeah, so part of the reason that we wanted to do this workshop about anti-oppressive facilitation is because we often ask people at QPIRG to submit workshop proposals to us for our event series. An event series that we have coming up soon is called Culture Shock, and it's an annual event series which is put on together between QPIRG McGill and SMU, and it's focused around anti-racism, migrant justice, and Indigenous solidarity. So this year the theme is Beyond the Horizon, which is looking at what will it look like when we get past this current point of collective struggle, and what are the visions for how communities will thrive in the future? How can we work backwards to understand, like, what is the work that we would need to do to get there, you know? So this year for Culture Shock, the events are mostly confirmed. It'll be happening between March 10th and March 19th. And we'll be getting the Facebook events up this week. So this year we have planned a movie screening of a really amazing film called Our Dance of Revolution that ties together histories of Black queer activism in Toronto with the more recent Black Lives Matter movement that's happened in the last 5 to 10 years. And we also have an art making workshop with the artists Shauna and Sarian Strauss, which will be a closed workshop for BIPOC, so Black, Indigenous, and people of color, to kind of use art therapy as a way to dream what their future self might be like. And we have quite a few other workshops coming as well, about one about colorism, and we have one that's about research. We have one workshop that's about conducting research as a marginalized person, so where to apply for grant money, how to find a research supervisor who will support whatever your topic is, those kinds of details. Those are a few of the things that we have planned.
Obviously, organizing events this year is really different. How have you found either organizing Culture Shock or the workshop in a couple days? How have you found adapting these things to an online form? Have you noticed it's been more accessible for people? More like, what? How has it been? Mm-hmm.
It's been really interesting to adapt our work to the online format. It's definitely a lot harder in terms of not having that presence on campus where people can just drop by and we can have those kind of small interactions with people. But that being said, it does seem like having events online has made them much more accessible to people. We haven't organized a ton of events yet. This will be our first kind of full event series since things went online. But from the one-off events that we've done, we've really seen that in some ways, not having to do like the physical logistics of actually bringing a bunch of things to the venue and finding a space that's accessible and all of that has made us a little bit more able to focus on finding topics that we're really, really, really interested in, and dreaming a bit bigger in terms of who we want to ask to participate in our events and that kind of thing. So that's been really interesting. And we have found that we've had really good attendance for a lot of our kind of internal and public activities compared to previous years, I would say. So it seems like, despite the little tech glitches that have definitely happened and the frustrations with relearning how to do your job in that kind of format, I would say overall that it's been a pretty valuable experience. And I think that, for example, our annual general meeting, which happens once a year, and we explain to the community what we've done in the previous year, essentially, is something that we might always have an online option for going forward, I think, because of how well attended it was compared to when we only do it physically. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great to hear. Yeah. So if people want to attend the get more information on the upcoming Culture Shock series, where can they go? How can they participate?
You can find all of the information on Kubrick McGill's Facebook page. We have a Facebook event for the event, and there's a link that you can follow to find it, which is tiny.cc/workshopcreation. That'll bring you to the Zoom link. For Culture Shock, it's the same thing. Probably the best place to find it is on Facebook. But if you're not on Facebook, you could also check our website, which is kubrickmcgill.org.
Well, thank you so much again for taking the time to chat with me.
Snowstorm in a town you forgot. I take advantage of a warm car and I recess my lot. So many years I've given up and now my youth seems shut. I take my place among the truckers and I show them what I got. I told the stripper at the bar that the shots we got were magic. Make a wish now come true. As she smiled, a golden tooth glinted in the she wished for, I just wished for you. say everything is possible, but I know that it's not true, especially not when it comes to you. Dreamy colors, red and gold. I never meant to cause you pain. And sweet, sweet forgiveness, you can go back, but it's never the same.
You're listening to Dragon Root Radio on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. That was a song by Little Scream called Heron and the Fox. And before that, we were speaking with Cupid McGill on their upcoming Culture Shock event series. Next up, we had the chance to speak with the founding editor of Cool Journal about their recent issue on queer feminisms. Here is that interview.
First, thanks for having me. So my name is Rewa Sawyer. I'm a queer feminist archivist, editor, and writer. I'm from Lebanon. I've lived in Lebanon my whole life, except now I have now moved to Paris, where I've been based for the past 6 months. And I'm currently doing my master's in gender studies at Paris 8, Université Vincennes-Saint-Denis. And I'm the editor, the founding editor of PEUL, a journal for body and gender research, and the co-founder of Intersectional Knowledge Publishers. And Intersectional Knowledge Publishers is the platform under which Kohal operates. So concerning Kohal, amazingly, we're already in our seventh year. and we have been producing knowledge for all of that time. And the idea behind Kohal was really to center and bring to the front knowledges that are not just produced, but that also exist among communities, the queer communities and feminist communities in the South, and particularly in West Asia and North Africa as the regions that we look towards. And we have been based in Beirut as a team for a very long time, except for the past 6 months, where we have moved, we have migrated to a transnational model, because we have literally like migrated in different places, where some of us are still based in Beirut, others in different places. I'm in Paris, someone else is in Istanbul. The idea behind this kind of knowledge that we bring to the front is to really rethink our imaginaries and be able to find a locality where we can make them concrete in a way and put them out into the world. And I think we're going to talk about this a bit more later. In terms of what we do in general, so this is particularly Kohal as a publication. But what we do in general, so we focus on three main axes. The way I see those axes is that they do not exist in, you know, like two-dimensional planes, but they're kind of circling each other. One of them is publication, so publication as a medium, as a means, but also publication as what you put out there. So it's both. So what the structure of publication, the means of publication, but also what is it that is being published. The second one is translation. Translation from a technical perspective, as in we translate knowledge, but also from a conceptual perspective, meaning what are the mechanisms that would inform such a process in the first place, and how is it that we can queer them and reclaim them and make them ours in a way. And then the third one is communities, I would say, because of how we perceive those axes to be revolving around something that is not just local, but that is also alternative and that has been sidelined, which is where we really find our histories since we started working and right now as well. So this is a short introduction, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Now, I was looking at the website, and one of the things it mentions is that the journal intends to, the quote is, provide non-exoticizing, non-minority platform to promote independent knowledge. So can you speak a bit to what this means as an academic journal and why it's important to center?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that when we started, when Kohal started in 2014, we were really invested in the idea of speaking back to, so positioning ourselves as a counter discourse to. And I think this was coming from this history of really being written, like our bodies, our narratives being written into other people's stories, publications, etc. And in a way, so we were written out of our own stories. And by this, there was a clear like dynamic or power dynamic that existed between journalists, researchers, etc., that would come from other localities with more access, with more resources, and be able to perceive us as subjects of research. And so I think the first years were really oriented towards this idea of speaking back to that, of offering an alternative to that, of resisting this kind of being written out of our own stories. But I think it's changed. I mean, we still believe that those power dynamics exist, like it's not about denying them. But I think what we're trying to do right now has shifted from this position of having to answer to someone or to a power agenda, like a bigger power all the time, to really going back to what is the work that we actually want to do? How is it that we want to organize? And how does this actually translate, whether in the publication means and content, or within the communities that we work with? And I think that what we've lived in Lebanon for the past 2 years has really consolidated the importance of that vision, in the sense that we do not want to or have to exist in relation to systems of power all the time and produce ourselves as such, but be able to also think of what is it that is important to us without existing in a vacuum, obviously, but how is it that we want to lead our struggle without being put in a position of response over and over again? And so this is to say that initially, yes, it's the idea is about, you know, non-exoticizing, non-minority, but those terminologies in a way are terminologies that respond to a discourse that would make us minority and make us or exoticize us in a way. So right now, what we are trying to do is shift that towards defining ourselves as a queer radical publication from the South, first queer in its politics, publication in, as I said, the means and the content, and then the South as a locality that is not geographical, but that is very geopolitical in a way. And another thing I'd like to mention about translation is the multilingual aspect of Kohan, because this is also, I mean, we are always called to produce knowledge in specific languages. And the idea that, and the notion that we can bring Arabic, for example, to the forefront of this struggle is also a way to break this dynamic of, you know, like systems holding the ability to produce knowledge and other systems that are more alternative, more minority, having to all the time respond to how they are being represented in a way.
Mm-hmm. And this is actually on a similar line to that, but as an academic and a feminist journal, can you speak to the importance of accessibility and access to the knowledge?
Well, I think like we can think about what access and accessibility mean first. So I think on the surface, I would like maybe talk a bit more about the open source aspect of doing such work, which was important for us because we felt that a lot of the conversations, and specifically theoretical conversations, are always somehow they're not freely available. And so one must either be part of an institution to have access to them, or be able to literally pay subscription fees in order to be privy to the conversations that happen. Unfortunately, those conversations, a lot of the times, are conversations that include us in the narratives that they present, and therefore by including us in those specific forms of circulation, we are excluded because we cannot access them in the first place. So it's kind of this, it's kind of a weird, I don't know how to call it, but it's, you know, it's being stuck into this loop in a way where we are called into as subjects of research, of interest, etc., but then we cannot have access to how is it that we are being represented. And this is a broader issue as well with how research is constructed as a whole. And maybe, you know, in the event that we will be doing, I think that we will be addressing this quite a bit. And we can talk about this a bit later. So in terms of the open access part of it, we've had to decide whether to have all of our content free and available and join the efforts of open source publishing transnationally. So that was one option. Another option was to have like subscription fees that would allow us a semblance of sustainability. We chose the first one, obviously. So clearly this means that economically the circulation and the funding that we have to rely on is not like we fully rely on a funding model that would not be the case had we had a subscription fees. So this was a kind of a political decision that we had to make and that we are working with right now. So this is in terms of, you know, the surface level of what open access means and what accessibility mean to such a project. But in terms of the circulation as well, it's also about who has access to saying what, in a sense, and who has access to theory, because a lot of the times we position theory as this medium that, you know, we cannot have access to because it's intellectual, because it's elitist, etc. And I would say to that actually theory has been made so that we cannot have access to it. But theory is something that exists, is something that we do. Theory is our praxis. It's what we do in our daily lives. It's what we do within our communities. It's what we do to organize. So we are theory embodied in a way. And I think this is what the conversation on access and accessibility denies us. Because then we are kind of, you know, isolated in those divisions of who is doing what and who can say what and who has access to what platform, that makes it impossible for us to project ourselves, to think of ourselves as having access to theory in the first place. And I think especially queer theory. And I think this is really one of the main points that we are trying to challenge in the work that we do.
Mm-hmm. That's a really interesting point and way of approaching it I hadn't thought of before. I want to talk a little bit more about the journal itself and the current issue, or from what I understand that is the current issue, number 6.3 on queer feminism. Can you tell us a bit about how this theme for this issue was selected and why it was important to dig into this theme?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, the issue on queer feminisms was published in December of last year, so about 2 months ago. And yeah, it's our sixth volume, so it marked the sixth year. We're in our seventh year right now, and it was the third issue of the past year. I think initially it has to do with how the idea of queer has been passed on in a way. And I'm talking about queer as a political position rather than queer as an identity. That's not where I'm looking at, basically. So I'm more interested in the political position and the theory. And I think a lot of times, because of what I was talking about earlier, like this binarization of where knowledge is centered and where it's peripheral, we are somehow told that queer is a genealogy that doesn't exist for people in the South. And I don't want to generalize. I'm talking specifically about West Asia and North Africa. And I think the idea of naming this issue queer is about saying that, no, actually, we do have a queer genealogy. And this is not how queer or theory is passed on. That's not the only way it can be passed on. So we're not just waiting as passive receptors for those theories to reach us, for them to make sense, because we can find them in our histories, in our ways of organizing, again, which is, you know, what I was saying about theory in general. So I think why queer feminisms? I think it's because we did not want to speak in euphemisms anymore, and we wanted to call it the way we were envisioning it, which is a political positioning that is both and is at once queer and feminist, and accounting for the plurality of it, the plurality of what this could look like as a political position rather than an identity, we went for queer feminisms in plural. Now, the way we worked with this issue was very different because it started with a writing workshop that was also called Queer Feminisms. So we first called for a writing workshop. We received quite a lot of applications and we selected 8 writing projects. And we then met in Beirut in November, end of November, beginning of December. 2019, and it was literally at the height of, you know, the revolution in Lebanon, or at least the revolution in its visible and mediatized component. And I think the way we worked around it was truly like it was a queer feminist moment, because we were discussing methodologies, we were discussing our bodies in space, our bodies in theory, while at the same time living this broader political moment in the streets, embracing us in a way, and that we could then have it meet us at the same time, embody it, having it embody us. So it was this kind of exchange at a different level that we had not, I think neither of us had experienced that before. So it was really embodying and living queer theory for days together as a collective. And there was some kind of collectivity that was formed as a result. And so these projects are now published in the issue, but we then opened it as well to other submissions. And so it is the collection of those writing projects plus other submissions that we received through our traditional call for papers and submissions. Why was it important to feature? I think because of the moment that we are in, whether as Kohal in terms of the politics that we are trying to bring to the surface and out into the world, but as well the political moment that we have been living, whether in the geography of Lebanon or regionally or even transnationally from the South.
And can you tell us a bit about some of the submissions you received for this issue, and if there were any kind of sub themes that particularly stood out to you or inspired you?
I'd like to stop a bit on methodology aspect of it, because for me, what makes this issue different is that there is a consistent challenge of what research methodology can look like. I mean, and I'm saying consistent because we've had that in other issues, but we haven't had that consistently in a whole issue. And I think what this issue does is really to make us think, what makes a piece publishable? What makes a piece research? What makes it count as research? And I'm aware that a lot of these questionings would not even make it to, to many journals, let's say. But we wanted specifically to kind of break this taboo in a way, this academic taboo of publication. And so I think I'd like to stop maybe at Sarona's piece on return, because at the very beginning, this project was very scholarly, let's say. and it wasn't just, you know, limited to this one person, but I remember that at the workshop, we kept talking about, this is all great, all of these pieces that we are reading are amazing, but where are you in this piece? And why is it that we have this compulsion to write ourselves out of the pieces that we are presenting to the world? And it's kind of a, I think it has to do with this disciplining of the academe, that we find ourselves compelled to just erase what is important to us. So Suture Fragmentations, Sarona's piece, ended up being not just in its content, but even the format of it, really breaking what is it that constitutes publication, and academic publication in particular, because of, you know, sometimes she would end in the middle of a sentence, like a paragraph in the middle of a sentence, and she incorporated her own poetry with pictures that she had taken. And I think it just embodies the way that we have really seen and thought of methodologies, queer methodologies that we would be working with from different localities and different imaginaries.
Now, as you mentioned a little earlier, there is an upcoming event to discuss the issue. Can you tell us a bit about the speakers and what audiences can expect?
Okay, so basically another thing, I think what we've been trying to do is to really have more public events, which has been, we had started with this effort with a lot of conferences and workshops, and it's been halted a bit because of the pandemic, obviously. So we're trying to pick it up again with online events. And so we thought that in order to do justice to this issue that has taken so much work, so much labor, and so much imagination and projection from so many of us, we thought that we would like to launch it officially in an online event. And my co-editor and I, so Sabiha and I, were thinking of potential discussants for the issue. And the idea behind that is to have somebody in the field of queer theory be able to address the work that we have done, the issue, the authors, us as the team of Kohol, the editorial team, but also our region and our political aspirations. And so we basically asked Sara Ahmed, who said yes. And so she will be the one responding to and maybe contextualizing what it means to have such a production or such a publication in a moment like the one that we are living right now. And so I think what is to be expected is an address by myself and my co-editor Sabiha, and then a presentation by four of our authors. We've already talked about Sarona. There will be three others as well, namely Aya, Ahmed, and Noor. And then there will be space for Sara Ahmed to discuss the issue and the theoretical contribution that it does, it makes. And then finally, we'll end with a Q&A. So basically, we opened registration and we literally, like, we had no tickets left within a few minutes. It was really, I think this is the biggest event that we will be moderating and organizing so far. So what we're doing instead is we'll have the event live streamed on Facebook so that it reaches the people who actually wanted to attend and in the spirit of open source publishing. So we would like it to be available to the public.
And for people who either attend the event or read the issue, what do you hope they take away?
I guess that it is possible to imagine different ways of doing theory, of doing in general. There are also different ways of being in terms of how is it that we organize, who do we respond to, under whose terms, and that imagining different means of production that do not rely on systems of power that we are trying to dismantle, means of production that are queer, that respond to our political imaginings are possible.
And if people want to learn more, if they want to attend the event or send in their own submissions to the journal, where can they go?
Okay, so they can go to our Facebook page, Kohal Journal, K-O-H-L and Journal, and we tweet at Kohal Journal, so K-O-H-L Journal. And our website is koholjournal.press. We have a call papers open right now. It's about a revolutionary archive of 2020, and people can send us submissions. Submit at koholjournal.press until March 31st for this particular issue.
Thank you so much again.
That was our interview with Kohal Journal on their recent issue on queer feminisms. We're going to end today's show with a clip from our interview with the hosts of Yoga is Dead.
So can you tell us about yourselves and how you met? And what made you decide to make this podcast?
Yeah, so this is Sejal here. I'll just tell you a little bit about my teaching journey. I started in 2013 teaching in vinyasa yoga, and then I started to get more training in various different topics. So I traveled from New York to Kerala, India for several different yoga teacher trainings focused on vinyasa yoga, hatha yoga, and restorative yoga. And then I've also trained in trauma-informed mindfulness-based practices through the Lineage Project here in New York. I have a background in prenatal techniques and some anatomy around the pelvic floor that I've learned through Living Now Yoga. And then in terms of all the other things I offer, I started a People of Color and Allies yoga series to honor inclusivity and diversity. I lead free yoga for all in the Battery in New York's Landmark Park downtown. And we just finished our sixth year, or we have two more weeks to finish that out. And I really aim that at democratizing yoga offerings, free and accessible for all. You can come, you can sit, you can practice if you want. I lead retreats with topics covering asana workshops, those trauma-informed practices I mentioned, and pelvic floor anatomy. And I also created a ABCD Yogi, which is an international community that supports any born conscientious Desi Yogi, which means a person of South Asian descent, to reclaim the yoga and mindfulness space by sharing their personal stories and practices with the whole world. And then I was featured on this year's 19 Women of Color to Watch in the Yoga World list. And on top of that, so on top of the podcast work that Jaisal and I do, and on top of ABCD Yogi, I also offer group vinyasa and restorative yoga classes at Humming Puppy, and I offer private yoga, and occasionally I offer level 1 and 2 Reiki. I also volunteer with the Lineage Project in a finance and operations capacity. So that's me in a big nutshell.
Jaisal here. I have been teaching yoga since 2010. And like Sejal, I've done lots of trainings in this world, everything from Raja Yoga in India, Vinyasa Yoga in New York, prenatal. I've done meditation courses, including a Vipassana training. the whole gamut, and tons of anatomy and mobility and all of those types of things. And so my teaching really focuses on making yoga accessible and empowering to the students that I work with, and supporting practical functional movement and lasting change. Most of my teaching centers on private yoga teaching, but I also teach one group class at the moment at a residential gym. And then I teach on staff at a couple of trainings. I've taught in the past anatomy and biomechanics. I also teach the asana punk, the portion of a prenatal training, the Mahamama prenatal training. And through that program, I also offer free and low cost classes through their alumni program. I also teach at, or I'm guest teaching rather, with Prema Yoga Institute's therapeutic training. I volunteer with World Spine Care Yoga Project, and I am the co-creator of the 19 Women of Color to Watch in the Yoga World in 2019. So that's me in a nutshell.
Wow. You mentioned it was vulnerable to create this podcast. You do delve into a lot of themes. Can you talk about how you go about choosing these themes for the episodes, and how you go about tackling these topics, because they're really vast and big and systemic. So can you tell us a bit about that process?
Sure. We chose the themes after a lot of deliberation. So the process was that we started this podcast process like over 2 years ago at this point, and we sort of went through an iteration of it for, you know, about a year. We probably didn't work on it as seriously as we do now, but over that year, we were kind of like thinking about all the things we want to talk about, mainly revolving around our personal stories. And then after that first year, we sort of went back to the drawing board and said, you know, we don't think this is compelling enough as is. So let's reorganize it. And that really helped us to focus in on, like, what do we want to do? We want to point out some of the things that are really going wrong in this industry, and that's why these things have happened to us. And then from that point, start to give action items. So far we've released 4 episodes, and in the way we have organized them, it's the same method. We suss out what the major touchstones are for each of the episodes. We use our personal stories and our research to highlight the points we want to make. And then we know we're speaking to 3 different audiences: the yoga student, the yoga teacher, and the yoga business owner. And so we end the episodes with action items with each of those audiences in mind.
As you mentioned, you end episodes with action items. That's something that I think is really cool that you incorporate into the kind of the process of the episode. Why was it important for you to put in action items in these episodes?
I'll take that. This is Sejal. It was kind of what Jaisal was saying. When we started to suss out how we were going to deliver this information, we realized we could take the angle of just being personal about it and going through the timeline of events and what we experienced. And that's fine. That's great information. It's more like you're catching up with a friend over a cup of cha or just like hanging out. But in terms of delivering a message to such a broad community and a potentially global community, we didn't want it to end there. We wanted people to relate to personal stories through whatever lens they were looking at it from. And then also say, yeah, I understand what you're saying, and I get why there's an issue. What do we do? And we wanted to be able to answer that question, saying, here's what we can do. And here's a whole plethora of information to back that up, and then ways to move forward so we can affect positive change. Because we realized the only reason we were putting ourselves out there in this vulnerable way is so that we could affect change, and that we wanted to deliver the tools to guide people there.
In the podcast, talk a lot about accessibility, financial accessibility, so many things. How do you incorporate those values into the making and production of the podcast itself?
We've been pretty intentional, I would say. And then we've also been able to review where we kind of made missteps and mistakes to incorporate more accessibility and more of our thoughts into action for the podcast. I've heard this phrase a lot, you know, where your energy, like focus on where your energy and dollars can go to create change. And we wanted to kind of take the same approach. So in creating our concept, and one of the ways we did that was by supporting women and women of color and people of color in making our podcast. So just the logistical aspects of it. Our design is done by someone who lives in Pakistan. Our music was done by a neighbor of mine who is Indian. Our podcast editor is a student of mine, a woman musician. And when we've decided to partner with people externally, we've made an effort to partner with organizations and offer our workshops with organizations that align on our mission of accessibility, inclusivity, and diversity. So we've done that by our workshops being low-cost options with sliding scale. We've offered discounts to our products. We have offered giveaways to see us at our workshop. And our podcast itself is free and accessible to anyone who can find it. And then throughout the process, people ask, do you have transcripts of what you've been doing? I can't hear them. So do you have a way for me to read them? And so we then started working on transcriptions of our podcast. And we have a group of volunteers that helps us transcribe and proofread the transcriptions. And that's also free in a readable format, PDF, and you can get it from our shop. The other thing that was really, really an interesting point of launching this podcast and then it being successful is how much people want to connect to us and share their stories and also give feedback and sometimes offer messaging and questions to us that doesn't feel very safe. So we've taken this approach where we respond to almost every single comment, direct message, and like Facebook message that we receive that doesn't feel threatening and isn't just an obviously hateful message. So we try to foster more communication through that. And outside of speaking directly with us, which sometimes we have limited time, I mean, more and more we have limited time. We've created a Facebook group directly through our Yoga is Dead Facebook page that is fostering even more conversation and community and even creating connections locally with people. And then we keep talking about these tips and these ways to move forward. I feel like continuing education is just another way of doing your yoga. You're constantly in inquiry about the things we're talking about and ways to do better in whatever socio-political environment you're in. And so we offer tips at the end of our episodes for the yoga teachers, students, and the yoga business owners on how to move forward with positive change. And we publish that comprehensive and free resource guide on our website so you can continue your investigation and your reading and your work after listening.
You are listening to Dragon Radio on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. We've come to the end of today's edition of Dragon Radio. We'd like to thank all of our guests and interviewees featured on today's show. Tune in 2 weeks from now for our special funding drive episode of Dragon Radio.
They'll never know I was gone. Against COVID-19 is now underway for priority groups. Visit quebec.ca/COVID vaccine to follow the vaccination sequence planned for your area and book your appointment online. If necessary, you can also call 1-877-644-4545. Once you've been vaccinated, it's important to continue to protect yourself by following the basic health guidelines. The vaccine, a safe way to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Hello and welcome. My name is Nick Schofield and you are listening to Underground Sounds on CKUT. Thanks for tuning in. I am with you on the airwaves every Monday from 8 to 10 p.m. playing all Canadian independent music. You can listen at 90.3 FM or online at ckut.ca. And I've been doing this show for about 8 years, and every Monday it's a pleasure to get to dive into this pool of amazing music that is constantly coming out. Like, there's just this fountain of creativity that cannot be stopped, and I'm just like scooping out a little cup of this amazing elixir and trying to splash it into the air and hope that you all get to hear some of it. And tonight's episode is extra special. It is International Women's Day, so most naturally I want to share some of the amazing music being created by women in Canada on tonight's program.